못하세요.
Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Let's just do this one for now. This is one line. Brahmai Vaham.
Brahmai Vaham. Brahmai Vaham Asmi.
Brahmai Vaham Asmi.
Iti. Aparoksha Jnanena.
Aparoksha Jnanena.
Nikhila.
Nikhila.
Karma Bandha Vinirmuktihi.
Karma bandha vinirmuktihi
syat
syat.
The key word here is aparoksha jnanam, and from the previous, remember I said I wanted to spend some time on what this aparoksha, the word aparoksha, means. In the previous verse, describing the Jivan Mukta, the one who is living liberated, first gives the example of the samsari, I am the body, I am the brahmana, I am the shudra, etc. And then it tells what is really the buddhi. What is the buddhi of the jnani? And that's the one who negates all of those upadis. Whatever the upadi is, there's no sense, I am that. In fact, no, I'm not that. So there's a negation, a neti neti, not this, not this, not this, I'm not a brahmana, I'm not a shudra, I'm not a purusha. Or whatever, and in whatever our culture, the things we tend to identify and label as ourselves, those things are negated. And then there's the positive, this is important also in the teaching, There has to be a complete negation of everything that you are not. But that's not enough. If you're not, what if I say, you know, you're not a Brahmana, you're not a Shudra, you're not this, you're not that, you're not the body, you're not the mind, you're not the sense organs, you're not the sister, you're not the brother, you're not the mother, you're not an employee, you're not an employer, you're not anything. Nothing that you identify, you're not that. Anything that you think of, that you think that you are, anything that can be objectified, no, you are not that. So it's an extensive neti neti, not this, not this, not this. So we can spend our lifetime with these negations, but even if you have negated absolutely every possible point of identification, the question still remains, who am I then? Who am I? And the who am I needs a positive assertion. We need the negation, the neti neti, not this, not this, not this, because we are, the buddhi is so convinced that I am this. And in fact, it's not enough to say I am not this, because the nishta, that nishtya jnanam, that firm, very firm conclusion is there. And so if I say, you're not the body, that's a negation. But what does it do for you, really? What do you mean, I'm not the body? That means you can make that, pause that negative assertion, but you have to prove it. You have to make a person see why. Why are you not the body? That viveka has to take place. You know, that discriminative analysis where you recognize that there's a subject-object differentiation between you and the body. And body now stands for anything that you can objectify and identify with. You have to see all of the logic. You have to be able to experience the fact of it. Like, for instance, that's why this drisha viveka is so thoroughly done. You're aware of the body. It's not only that you have a subject-object relationship with the body. That's one thing. But the other thing that's very important is that your experience of the body, even while it is here, is time-bound. Right? You might be thinking of the body or identified with the body right now, paying attention to it. But at another time, you may be driving your car listening to an audiobook. And there is no focus on the body at all. It's just automatic. It's not as though you're perceiving the body, right? It's the same with your mind. Your mind is active. And so whatever is going on in the mind, you're thinking about, you're perceiving. Say you're having a daydream. Then your whole reality, the experience of your reality, is the daydream. Right? That's what's happening for me right now. Then you have to come back to the body. So that's why they go into this waking, that being the sakshi of the waking, dream, and deep sleep, because these three states of experience negate every possible point of identification you could have. Because when the dream state is up, everything you identified with in the waking state is down. It's not there. The dream experience replaces the waking experience. You can say, yeah, but we know the waking experience is still there. I mean, I do wake up to the same body. That isn't the point. Any experience you can be without is not you. Because your being also is an experience. If you say, I am a conscious being, or you recognize this me, and this me contains as its swabhava, as its nature, dukkha. Or it contains as its nature, dreaming. Or it contains as its nature, sensory perception. Then that has to be there as part of its nature. It's what it is. So sensory experiences are there, one with the Atma. But that isn't true. Sensory experiences come and go even in the waking state, because you can be lost in your imagination. Yeah. You can also, when you go to bed at night, there's not a dream or waking state. So what I'm saying is that we think that because we know, say you're dreaming or deep sleeping, okay, in deep sleep, you know, I'm not aware of anything at all. There's just pure ajnana there, and I remember that state when I wake up. But I know now that I'm awake I know that these three states of experience are there. They exist. And I have an identification with those. So you can't tell me that just because I'm not experiencing them, I'm not them. Well, that's exactly what I'm telling you. If you don't experience them, if they can be outside of your experience, they're not intrinsic to your being. That experience is not intrinsic to your being. You can never be outside or away from the experience that is your being, that is your own being, because that's who you are. That's what you are. Any other experience can come and go. That's fine. It's an experience that comes and goes. It all belongs to Maya. So all of these Maya experiences have to be identified as such, and I have to understand this tenet because we don't usually think about it like this. If I don't experience it, it's not me. I don't think about it like that because really of the waking dream deep sleep state, because in the deep sleep I don't experience the waking or the dream, but I know I'm the waker and the dreamer, you know, even though I'm not experiencing it. If I look over to my right and I'm only experiencing this side, you know, this view, then I'm not experiencing that view, but we know it's still there, right? We know it's still there. I know it's still there too. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the experience of it. Here, there's this experience. Here, there's this experience. Here, there's this experience. But I'm there in all three of them. I'm here experiencing this. I am here experiencing this. I am here experiencing this. Right? Through my sense organs. If I ask you to do some sort of an active imagination where you, now what if I say, imagine yourself walking along an ocean. But as I tell you, the imagination probably pops right up. You're walking along an ocean. I say, now you're deep in the forest, deep in the woods and listening to all of the sounds of the animals. Okay, now you're deep in the forest listening to all of the sounds of the animals. Totally different experience. Now you're walking down a city street and listening to all of the honking and the rabble-rousing of many, many, many people all at the same time, and now you're experiencing that. Okay, that's very different than the experience of the forest and very different than the experience of the ocean scene. But the one thing for certain is that you're there in every one of them, right? But they're not there. They're not there. When you're experiencing the ocean, you're not experiencing at all, this forest scene, nor the city scene. They totally negate each other. So experiences, those are just, we're talking now just subtle experiences. The one experience negates the other, negates the other. You're never negated. You're the Adhishtana of every, you're there for every single experience that you have. But the content of each one of those experiences is continually negated. In fact, if you think of it within samsara, that every experience is coming into being and going out of being and changing continually. You're not, right? So when you think of experiences, whether they last a long time or they don't last a long time, your being is there for that long-lasting experience. And when negated, it's there for the next short-lasting experience. It doesn't really matter how long the experience is. If it exists in time, you know, if it exists in time, if it exists within time and space, within samsara, every single experience you have comes and goes. Now, another thing. Remember that the experiences that you have are vrittis. We accept that this is Ishwara Srishti, this world that we experience in the waking state, for instance, it's Virat. But our experience of Virat, right, of Ishwara, in the term, as this physical upadi, this physical universe, right, this experience itself is continually changing, and then I am the witness of that. I am the witness of that experience through my prarabdha karma or whatever happens to be coming on. But the point is, on the experience of it, how? Through the vritti. Through a vritti. My sense organs land on this experience, and all the five sense organs give me a motion picture in my mind, in the vritti, in the form of the vritti, whatever is going on. Okay. Now, vrittis, you know, vrittis come and go. Vrittis are our experiences. Now, say this, here's this world here, and I'm having an experience of this world, whatever I'm perceiving, I have a vritti of it. And then I shut my eyes. Now, that's very powerful. What happens, now you're having, don't forget about the ears and all of that, just think of how powerful this is. This is the nature of experience. You're having an experience of this room, you're seeing this room and everybody in it. Now what happens, you shut your eyes, and what has just happened to that experience? Now the sense organs, the sense of sight, is being covered by your eyelids, so that experience is not there. What is your experience? The me experience. From the standpoint of a jnani, you would say, first I saw the room, I experienced the room, then I shut my eyes, and now I don't have the experience of the room from the standpoint of my eyes. And so now, as we start to really analyze the nature of our experience and where experience comes from, objectifiable experience, where does it come from? We have to say it exists within the creation, and we're aware of it, aware of these experiences through our means of knowledge. Right? Through our sense organs for the waking state, and for the dream state, it's really just the activity from the citta and the manas, from the memory and the manas, putting together this scene, you know, which now, because it's in the manas itself, I simply experience it. When I go to deep sleep, what happens? The manas is in causal condition, and what is my experience? My experience is of causal condition. Now what I say, that's my experience, will I say that I am the causal condition that I wake up from and talk about how well I slept last night? Or would I say that the dream experience, I am the dream experience? I don't think so. What about the waking experience? Well, the waking experience is more real. Not really. Not the waking experience. It's not more real. Within the waking experience, everything, experiences come and go and go. They're completely negated in the dream state. In the waking state, there's not even a knower there. Now, the thing is, that's all fine, but remember we're just talking about experience, the experiences that you're having. Now the question is, in every single experience that you're thinking of, can there be a viveka between your being and the experience? Viveka means, can there be a discrimination? Means, can you recognize, with the help of the teacher, because until you come to knowledge, we don't even think about it, usually. But with the help of the teacher, can you recognize that the experiences that you have come and go, and you remain? The me, myself, is ever present. And the experiences, everything about them comes and goes. I remain exactly the same. And so, how can I be the experience? Not only that, my being can't be any other experience other than what it is. Because I can't objectify my experience and become an object in the creation. I just simply am. Okay, so, now in this teaching, this viveka has to take place, and the logic, this logic has to go along with the experience. With the experience, you have to see the logic of it. Also, you have to recognize the fact of it, and you have to understand the logic of it, because the number of births we have are beginningless. They're beginningless. And so the mind, our mind, is totally entrenched in ajnanam, in self-ignorance. And being from beginningless time entrenched in self-ignorance, right? It recognizes me as me. That never changes. The Atma, which is Brahman, is my ever-present experience of me, my changeless experience, no matter what experience I'm having, objectifiable experience I'm having, but it's seen through the lens of the upadis, of the body, mind, sense organs. And because I, the I that is Brahman, the me that is timeless, the me that is the very one from whom the whole creation comes, this me, from this ajnanam, from the jiva upadis that are suffer really from the limitation that we call ajnanam, has no way of differentiating me, this constant, the constant, from the experience. There's no way of doing that. And so there's a very strong nischa jnanam, strong commitment on the part of the mind that it, the mind, is the self. And so whatever the mind is enjoying, whatever vrittis it's having, that's me. That's what's happening to me. And now I'm really sad. Now I'm happy, thank goodness. Now I'm just kind of sleepy or whatever. Whatever the upadis, experiences the upadis, means those points of ahankara, those points of identification, whatever comes up, that I am. You know? But you have to realize what's coming up are our experiences. And in every single one of those experiences, there is a viveka to be done. There is a recognition that I am there, me, is there in every single one of the experiences. And the experiences all come and go. So now, as we start to understand this through all of these prakriyas, then there's something else we need to recognize in this self-experience, the one who is ever-present. Okay, like I am happy, I am sad, I'm looking at this, I'm looking at that, I'm listening to this music, I'm listening to that music, I'm studying my books, whatever. All of these experiences have my self-identified self, you know, as their adhishtana, means I am present there to every one of those experiences. And then if we ask, how do you know you're present? How do you know you are there, this me? How do you know? I know because I know. That's a good answer. I know because I know, because consciousness is the me is self-evident. I don't know because there's somebody else looking in on me. I don't know because the mind that I'm illumining is illumining back at me. Like the mind has some consciousness, I have some consciousness. It's not the mind doesn't have any consciousness. Otherwise it would be its own little entity. And I would say hello to it and it would say hello back. That doesn't happen, right? There aren't two me's. Yeah. So this self, how is the self? I'm talking for ajnanis, people who have no self-knowledge. We say, how is this self known? Well, it's known experientially because it is consciousness. It is self-evident. What you don't know, you know, and why we need knowledge is not because we don't have the self-experience. We know very well who we are. And that's eternal. That's timeless. Your self is timeless. You don't need self-knowledge to have a self-experience. It's just that because that self-ignorance is there, right, then I'm having my self-experience along with the experiences of the mind, etc., where this mutual superimposition is taking place. So it's not a question of needing Vedanta to shine a light somewhere so that you can find yourself that is not here right now. That isn't the problem. The problem is the self-ignorance that causes the misidentification of yourself with the upadis. That's the problem. And it's the job of the Upanishads to work as a pramana to remove that mutual superimposition caused by self-ignorance. That's what's happening. So we actually say knowledge is not about giving you an experience of the self. That experience is already there. It's me. It's there as self-evident conscious being. But it's about removing these false points of identification. It's called ajnana nivritti. So when we gain atma-jnanam, it's really not a gain of the knowledge of the self. It's a removal from my self-evident self-experience of all of the mistaken notions. It's a removal of the ignorance. So we have self-ignorance. The ignorance has to be removed. The self is always there, being experienced, but experienced always in conjunction with these other things, and so there's a misidentification taking place. So now they say, even in this previous verse, and the one that we're doing now, this nischaya jnanam for the jnani, having recognized I am not Brahman, I'm the chit akasha, etc., which takes place for the one who has aparoksha jnanam. Aparoksha jnanam. Such a person is a jivan mukta. Here it says, Brahma eva aham asmi iti aparoksha jnanam. So what needs to take place? They're saying knowledge needs to be gained, but it's a particular type of knowledge. And that knowledge is called aparoksha, aparoksha jnanam. So we have to understand what aparoksha actually means. Okay. So, in the Vedanta, and in fact, in all of the darshana system in India, there's been a lot of epistemology. How do we know what we know? And so, the major, here, I'm just going to run through briefly the major means of knowledge that every human being has available, you all have available to you. The first one of this that we're going to talk about is called pratyaksha. It means, on first glance, it means sense perception. What I perceive through my five sense organs. So it gives me sense perception, gives me direct, immediate knowledge of something that I'm objectifying, subject to object, within the world. Okay? So just like if I asked you, what is sense perception for? Well, it's to gain knowledge of the objects that these individual sense organs can perceive in the world. There's another type also of sense perception that gives direct, immediate knowledge. It's called sakshibhasya, that which is to be illumined by the witness. So what they're talking about that, in terms of giving this direct experience, is like, say you have an emotion, or an imagination, or you bring up a memory. There's a direct, immediate experience of that. You know, so you now have the memory's a little questionable, so we won't use that for right now. But if you have an imagination, you're doing deep inner work, whatever you are doing is taking place in the mind, which is sattva. And so whatever takes place in the mind is known. Okay? And so these types of content being not given to me by the sense organs, but only by the mind, are differentiated from the direct knowledge that we have when the sense organs are operating versus the direct knowledge we have when I'm having just like an experience of something which the mind itself can come up with without the use of the sense organs. Like you're taking your imagination, taking a walk, your emotions. Your emotions aren't objectified by the sense organs, but they arise, and as they arise, you're aware of them. So the most important thing about pratyaksha is that it's a direct, immediate experience with nothing intervening. Yeah. And so pratyaksha is really the only one of the means of knowledge that we have that give this direct, immediate knowledge, except for atmajnanam, which we'll see, but that's different. Another one, just to run through the rest of them now, are indirect. Like, for instance, if I say anumana, which means inference. Inference is indirect, because the example would be, if I see smoke on the hill, I infer fire, because I know there's an invariable relationship. But I'm not seeing the fire. I'm seeing the smoke. So something else has to happen for me to know that there's fire there. I have to wreck. There's another operation that takes place that makes this indirect. See what I mean? Even though that invariable concomitance, that invariable relationship, is there, everybody knows it, but it, because it's there and because everybody knows it, you can see the smoke and infer fire. But you don't have a direct experience. There's another one called artopathy. That means it's presumption. And that's a little different than inference, but it also requires a second act. That's when I wake up in the morning and there's puddles all over the place, way more than any hose or group of hoses could do. Okay. So we just automatically presume, well, it rained last night. You know, because we know of nothing else in our experience that could cause so many puddles and so much dampness all over the place. We just presume it, you know. That's a presumption, but we're not experiencing the rain. It's indirect. We're experiencing the puddles. And then we have to make a calculation, so to speak, that, yeah, there's nothing else that could cause that, therefore it rained last night. There's another interesting one called anupalabdhi. It means non-cognition. It's also indirect. Say if, like these glasses, say if I forgot my glasses, and so I went ahead to go back to my room. I have to go back because I can't see without them. Sorry, just excuse me for 5 minutes. I have to go get my glasses. You know. And so I go up to my room, and I know that I put my, I'm positive actually, I've left my glasses on the bed right next to my computer there. And so I went to get them, and I looked. No glasses. The glasses aren't there. How do you know the glasses aren't there? Do you see that they're not there? You can't see something that's not there, right? Mm-hmm. There's no way to see it because it's not there. So this is called non-cognition, but I have to make a jump. You know, there's something that has to put two and two together. I thought the glasses were there. They're not there. What is there is everything else. And so I know that the glasses aren't there, but not because I see them. I can't see them. So there's another operation that takes place in the mind. So I'm going to use this example. How do you know there's not an elephant sitting in the middle of the room? You're like, there's no elephant in the middle of the room. How do you know that? Because I can see there's no elephant sitting in the room. No, you can't. You can't see no elephant because it's not there to be seen. So this is another indirect knowledge, you know. There's a few others like indirect. I'll leave out a couple of them now just for time. But just to understand, all of these are indirect. And also, there's what we call shabda pramana. The shabda pramana means that, which is rampant. It means knowledge that is indirect, that takes place through the use of words. So there's also an indirect knowledge there, but we'll see that in a minute. There's knowledge that all your textbooks at school, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of other people's work, you know. Like when, at school, if I have dissertation students, some of them are doing research, a lot of them are doing theoretical research where they're standing on they're becoming very informed about a particular topic by reading everybody else's work and then combining that with some other type of work. Like I wrote a dissertation once on Jung and Advaita Vedanta. Jung doesn't know Advaita Vedanta, and Advaita Vedanta doesn't know Jung, but I found just in my own life and work that the understanding both of these together was very useful for, in terms of Antakarna Shuddhi, and was very good for mumukshus to understand these things. Okay, so there we're putting together things that all of the knowledge that has already been gained to come up with something else, all indirect. Yeah. But that's shabda also, where knowledge that has been gained is passed on. You don't have to go I don't have to go reinvent Jung. I don't have to reinvent Advaita Vedanta and start from scratch. You know, I use this knowledge, and standing on this knowledge, we can produce something else. So all of these are indirect, and so how can any of these, they're called paroksha. All these I've just talked about, they're all called paroksha. The first one is pratyaksha. It means that which is in the range of your sense organs, or directly in the range of the different types of vrittis that your mind can produce on its own. That's direct immediate knowledge. All of these other means of knowledge, indirect. You see something and then you infer or you presume, you know, or you recognize the existence, the lack of existence of something else. There's always another step. That's what makes it indirect. And so even in the Shabda, the use of words, like you use it all the time, like asking somebody for directions, you have no idea how to get somewhere. You ask somebody and they give you the directions, you follow their directions and you get there. You use it all of the time. But the thing is, the Shabda Pramana, which the Advaita Vedanta falls under, can also give direct knowledge. Okay. So first of all, I want to say this. We have the direct knowledge of pratyaksha, what I can see, what I can objectify directly, immediately. We have all of the paroksha. Paroksha means your eyes, you know, do not come into contact with the other. It's far away. It's away from the range of your sense organs. That's called paroksha. So we, in English, we call it indirect. So we've got pratyaksha, direct knowledge, paroksha, indirect knowledge, and then we have aparoksha. Aparoksha means not indirect. So you've got direct knowledge, sense perception, vrittis in the mind. You've got indirect knowledge, things that you have to take another step to be able to. You never get to see it, but you know it from inference or presumption, etc., or non-cognition. You know, that's indirect. But how do I gain self-knowledge? Self-knowledge can't be direct. It can't be pratyaksha. It can't be something that I directly objectify, because I am not an object to be objectified. I am the eternal subject, right? That's why when we do the Driksha Viveka, we discover actually that this I thought was the subject, but actually it's an object. It's objectified by the mind and the sense organs. Okay, then I thought my sense organs were the subject. No, they're objectified by the mind. You know, if they work or they not work, you're aware of them. They're objectified. Okay, I'm the mind then. No, you're not the mind. You're a term. The mind is a fantastic instrument that objectifies the sense organs and then also can do all kinds of functions on its own, can have all kinds of emotions, but the mind itself is known, right? And so all of these things that are objectified, they can't be me, right? And so anything that can be objectified, first of all, is not you. And so therefore, you can't have direct knowledge of it as you can have direct knowledge of anything that you can turn your sense organs toward or your mind toward. Anything. Even space, time. You can be aware of ignorance. You can be aware of knowledge. You can be aware of all of your relationships directly, immediately. Pratyaksha. And then there's book learning and all kinds of, you know, indirect types of knowledge. You can have all of that. But do you think that direct knowledge or indirect knowledge can give you knowledge of yourself? If direct knowledge means pratyaksha, basically what can be objectified, that's what it means, what can be directly, immediately objectified, can I, the Atma, be an object of the self? Can I be an object of my sense organs? Can I be an object of my mind? Can there be a subject-object relationship there? Right? And we have to say, actually, no. There can't be, because myself can't be an object within Maya. It can't be objectified. It can't be an object within time and space. It can't be an object to my sense organs. It can't be an object to the mind, which is illumined by the self. So that's, I'll explain that in a bit when we get to the aparoksha. And how can it be indirect when you're here? You're right here. The self is right here. Well, you have to get indirect knowledge. This is actually some schools of thought. Mm-hmm. Indirect knowledge, you study the philosophy, you study the Vedanta philosophy. Understand it. Get an understanding and then go meditate and try to realize it. No. Why should you go study something and then go meditate and try to realize something that's already completely evident? Don't you think, this is Swamiji's words, don't you think he would have realized it by now? I mean, you're always here. You're always here, never not here, no matter what the vritti is. Go back, you know, to infinitely, to beginningless time, you're here. If you could have realized it by now, you would have realized it by now. If your pramanas, if your means of knowledge were capable of giving you knowledge of your being, that would have happened long, long, long ago. But yourself is not in the sphere of these means of knowledge that we have available to us. It's also, of course, not in the sphere of indirect knowledge. How can I be indirect when I'm here? That's not going to work, you know. So it would have to be some sort of pratyeksha, you know. But then that's not going to work either, because we're talking about vrittis that the mind can conjure up, which are illumin for pratyeksha, or sensory perception. I'm not going to fall into either one of those. In fact, I am the luminary that lights up those vrittis. So then we say, oh, that's true, okay. So no pratyeksha, no immediate, no direct knowledge, no indirect knowledge. We say, what's left? How about aparoksha, not indirect? So there's only one thing, in a sense, that's aparoksha, not indirect, and that is you. Because yourself is self-evident. Because it's self-evident, and the luminary, because of which everything else is known, even the pramanas that you use, it's the luminary which lights those up. Those pramanas, those means of knowledge we have, can't turn around and look at me. That's outside of their range, you know. But what if I'm what we call swatasiddha? Swatasiddha means I am self-evident. To be self-evident means I don't require a pramana. I don't require any kind of pramana. The whole universe can go away and I'm self-evident as conscious being. I don't need another light to come and light me up. Which is also why the aparoksha nature of myself is known to all beings experientially. Like, you don't have to have knowledge to say, yeah, I'm a conscious being. You're not going to say, no, I'm not a conscious being. No, I don't exist. I mean, that's mental. Everybody will say, yes, I'm a conscious being. But then if we ask, you know, but does the conscious being that you are, is it like an epiphenomenon of the body? Is it something that the body gives you, or does it belong to the mind? I don't know. That's why I want to go to the Himalayas and find my teacher. You know, that's why I need a guru, because I know I'm here, but I don't know who I am. I know I am, and I know I'm a conscious being, but I have no idea who I am in the scheme of things. What's my relationship to this world? What's this conscious being, this me? What's my relationship to the world? What's my relationship to this body, mind, sense organs? I know the body dies. Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? Do I transmigrate? Is there a subtle body that's responsible for me, for my being? I don't know. I just know that I am, and that I am a conscious being. Now, in fact, that self, you both know and don't know. You know yourself experientially, I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. But contextually, you don't know. You don't know if the self comes into being and goes out of being. You don't know the relationship of myself to yourself. You don't know the relationship of myself to Ishwara, to God, if there is a God. These things we don't know, you know. The relationship of myself to my mind, all of it. You know that you are here, but the context isn't there. And so what is the Vedanta as a pramana? Vedanta is viewed as a pramana. Actually, it's viewed as a shabda pramana, a pramana that takes place through the use of words to give direct, immediate knowledge. Now, how could it give direct, immediate knowledge? How could words, we know words can give indirect knowledge. How can words give direct, immediate knowledge? Only if the one they're giving knowledge of is already here. If it's already you, if it's already here, then the words through lakshya, They can, not through the immediate meaning of the words, we've seen this, the Vatscharta and the Lakscharta, but the implied meaning, the directed meaning of the words, they can point to you. The words can point to you, removing from you, making you recognize, taking off all of the dresses, all of the upadis, which actually you objectify. So this is all direct in all of the whole teaching. It's just making you recognize certain things that the mind had no pramanas, had no means to really recognize or know. But then when the Upanishads hold up this mirror, all of a sudden it's like the Upanishads are telling you something that you've always known, but never been able to say or never even been able to think. But you've always known it, and you've always known it because it is who you are. So that who you are has not been gone anywhere. You've always been here, but because of the ignorance, you know, it's been only seen in relationship to the dresses, the upadis that you're wearing. So the Upanishads take off all of those upadis one by one by one, and the Twampada, the you that is left after stripping off all these upadis, all using the words to do that, because you see all the way along, then what is left with you as you is the one who is self-evident me. And the most wonderful experience in that whole process is that the one that is left is me. You negate all of these things, and you're not never have any experience of negating the one who is most dear, your own self. So now all of a sudden, I become one who is not wearing any upadis. That all has to be pointed out. The teaching now has to give a lot of positive assertions for you to help you to recognize your nature. Do you see this? Do you recognize this? Do you recognize this? Do you see that space has been objectified? Where if space is objectified, how am I different from you? As consciousness, the bodies are all different, we know that, but how am I different from you if even space is objectified? What's between us? Space. No, space is objectified. So what makes two of us? So these are all the logics that come in that have to point to your own nature, which is already here. So the whole, every Upanishad, every Prakarana Granta is making you see something and giving you the logic for your mind to understand. Both are necessary. You see something and then you see why you see that, why you experience that, and what it means to experience that. All of that has to be taught. But it's all taught through words, which are pointing at these things as that exist. Because you are here, not as an object, but as yourself, the words can point to it like they can point to anything else. Words can point to anything. But the thing they're pointing to should be here. Right? For the direct sense, I am here, the words can point to me and make me see what I am not, and then leave and give positive assertion for what I am. That is called aparoksha jnanam, not indirect. It's direct, immediate knowledge. That's what that means. The famous example, I'll give this example and then we'll do more in the next class. One of Swamiji's examples that's fun. His one, and he uses it all the time, he got a kick out of it. He was on the train going up to Rishikesh to give a three-month summer camp. And so he was going, and he was just on the train, and somebody came and sat next to him. And that person was also, you know, going to Rishikesh. And the person started talking to Swamiji and says, I'm going to Rishikesh, I'm going to attend this camp by Swami Dayananda Saraswati, you know. And he was excited about it and said it's hard for him to get away, and they had all this conversation about it. Swamiji was just kind of smiling. So then Swamiji said something like, so you're going to the camp? Yeah, you know. And he said, do you know who's teaching it? Yes, yeah, Swami Dayananda Saraswati is teaching it. Then Swamiji said, I'm that Swami Dayananda Saraswati. Really? Yeah. But how would he know? He's never seen a picture of him or anything. He's just heard about him. There's hundreds of sadhus. So what would make him think that that sadhu is Swamiji. Why would he think that? It didn't cross his mind. But then when Swamiji said, I am that, then all of a sudden, you know, the one that he was going to see is this one. That's a direct, immediate knowledge, but the person is there. There's an ajnanam there. That ajnanam is removed. And the person who is just a sannyasi is now recognized as the Swamiji he's seeking. That's a nice example. There's many such examples, you know. Maybe next class we'll do the 10th man story. You all know that. But the 10th man story is another great example of shabda pramana. The pramana that uses words to give direct, immediate knowledge, which is called aparoksha jnanam. It can do that because the self is swata siddha. It is self-evident. It doesn't require a pramana for it to be known experientially. It requires a pramana to remove from it all of the things that it is not. You know, because it requires a pramana to remove the ajnanam so that these false identifications can be removed. So that's called swata siddha, that which does not require any pramana because it's self-evident. Another one is swaprakasha. The atma is swaprakasha. It's consciousness. So it doesn't need another consciousness to light it up. And so then we don't need a pramana to light it up or to experience it. We need a pramana to remove the self-ignorance that has caused these projections upon it. Cause things to be an upadhi. And so when we're talking about self-knowledge, we say this knowledge is aparoksha jnanam. It's a direct, immediate knowledge that takes place through shabda pramana, through the use of words that remove the ignorance that has caused the self to be taken, my being to be taken, as an upadhi, basically, and more. So that's enough. A little more to do. We'll do it next time.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.